Beyond Governance, Making Sense of Doing Business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.
A very good morning to you, the beloved listeners of Beyond Governance here at 101.9 High FM. I am truly honored once again to share this space and time with you as we continue to make sense of a very complex world around us. My name is Nimrod Obambele. As we proceed, the date of the election is approaching fast. We left with just over a few weeks before we cast our votes. Talking of votes, the Independent Electoral Commission announced that there are about 35 political parties that will be contesting the national provincial elections. I hope you have done your research on a party of your choice. This opposition, for me, is more relevant towards the new entrants in the market, so to speak. There's about 568,000, just over a million, just over above half a million voters who are new, and that's for me. We need to have a government that takes us very seriously. We need a cabinet that is responsive to the needs of the electorate. We need cabinet that comprises of men and women of stature and on whose social standing is impeccable. No smaller than the skeletons in the closet, so once said the Minister of Social Enterprises, I think Minister of Social Services, but Thabile Dlamini at some point. We do need a government that is appreciative of importance of meritocracy in the appointment of the ministers, deputy ministers, director generals, as well as senior government bureaucrats such as chief directors. I'm confident that we should have, you know, once we have elected well, I would imagine, depends on how defined well, would have a government that embraces high performance standards accompanied by a high accountability culture. The country will certainly be on upward trajectory in terms of public perceptions. On that note, if you still listen or read the political manifestos of most political parties, some of them have some sound economic thought processes, while others certainly just a lot of rhetoric. So we have to really, you know, make see trees from the forest, if you like, by really casting our votes next to a party that will make a significant difference as we proceed. Anyway, this is not about political manifestos or political parties. It's about corporate governance lapses. Before anyway, I just wanted to flag that particular issue, just to remind us of what is up and coming. In today's episode, as I've alluded earlier, we're putting a spotlight on governance, corporate government lapses in private and public sector organization. And this suggests, in my view, a lack or depth of ethical leadership, which is at the heart of governance. In South Africa, we've had our share of scandals. We've seen a series of, companies such as Tonga Tunet, which has been in the public domain for nefarious reasons, VBS Bank, KPMG, McKinsey & Company. All these companies were implicated. I mean, in the same vein, the public sector is also marred with these kind of controversies. You look at what happened at university such as Zululand, scandals there. Tshwane University of Technology, Walter Sisulu, Vaal Technology, Central University of Technology, and now recently, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, NSFAS. So all these entities, they must have something in common, and we need to account, or perhaps maybe have a deeper a sense of what is actually going on. For these are institutions of critical importance. If we have been let down by these institutions, who's supposed to guide the economy, who's supposed to guide the trajectory of recovery, we are in a serious trouble. Anyway, in making sense of this painful governance headache, I would imagine, I'm joined by Ian Jacobsbeck, who's the director at Fluxmint. Without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to welcome Ian. Ian, good morning and thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Nimrod. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. I've painted the scene again in terms of what we have seen in both private and public service organization. What would you say is your overall view of government lapses in these entities?
Well, as you said, we've got instances of corporate governance lapses throughout the public sector. We've got in the private sector, and there are numerous reasons why this has happened and different reasons in different institutions. We've seen our universities, number of universities that have been placed under administration. We've seen a number of municipalities, for that matter, that have been placed under administration after receiving unfavorable audits. And then, of course, as you mentioned, we've had our highly publicized cases of Steinhoff and Tonga Hewlett in the private sector. And then we all know all too well about the state of some of our state-owned enterprises like SAA, Transnet, Eskom, and there are different factors that have led to these institutions reaching the state in which they are, because they are all governed in different ways. They're governed under different statutes with different management structures. So one would have to look at the different management structures in each type of institution to see what the endemic problems are.
Thank you very much for that overview, which really is quite useful in us, really applying our minds, given the different statutes that you've made reference to, different management structures that you've made mention of. And we are, based on your overview, we are clearly in a big crisis. Before we get into the real nitty-gritties in terms of what are some of the salient points that we need to be looking at in trying to solve it, because there's no point of just talking more about this problem. We need to get to a point where we are able to offer solutions or package of solutions that will remedy some of these issues. Let's take a break. We'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. If you haven't really missed anything so far, we've just literally started. I'm in the company of the esteemed guest in the name of Ian Jacobsberg, who is a director at Fluxmint. We are talking about government lapses, and before we took the break, he was giving us an overview from his perspective in terms of what account for some of these issues that we've spoken about. Ian, one of the issues that you raised, which would perhaps maybe would give us a sense of, we have to start somewhere, we have to start somewhere by looking at the appointment processes, because junk in, junk out, there's also issues of organizational culture. But in your view, the appointment of council or board members in these institutions, council in a context of universities, board members in the context of private, what's your overall assessment of the skills and competencies some of those people? Because maladministration and corruption, obviously one has to look at a plethora of issues, but from a fit and purpose perspective in relation to skills and competencies.
It's hard to say sort of where things have got, where it's easy to say with retrospect where things went wrong in particular organizations. I think we're certainly in the private sector, there are various guidelines that have been laid down both by the Companies Act and then under subsequently by the various the King Codes. Had the 1973 Companies Act in effect for a long time, which was eventually replaced in 2008 by our present Companies Act, which went a lot further than the previous Companies Act into legislating what were regarded as the common law duties of directors, such as duties of good faith, duties to avoid conflicts of interest, the duty to act in the best interests of the company, to exercise care and skill, and all of these are now legislated in the Companies Act. I think what has happened is that that was never really legislated previously, and to this day, I don't think necessarily those requirements have been rigidly enforced within companies. And they only become apparent when companies are in trouble and when they get into the news. Then, for example, in the Steinhoff case, has been various reasons have been given and as to why what went wrong. And I think that is endemic to a number of companies. They talk about the tick box method of compliance, so that you've got, in terms of the Companies Act, in terms of the King Codes, you've got various requirements that have to be attended to. And if one then looks at annual reports of many companies, they certainly do, as they say, tick the boxes. But whether that's actually being lived within the culture of the company is a different story.
Quite keen to go slightly deeper, because the issue that you raised, which is expected, via the Companies Act and the King Codes in terms of the duties and responsibilities of the, of directors. I mean, who are expected to act in the best interest of the company and have a duty to care and have to be methodical in the assessments of reports. And you're quite correct that most of the annual reports appear to have ticked all the relevant boxes. But what does it say, from the shareholders' activism, because gone are those days where shareholders in the private sector, for an example, were just happy to see the returns and huge dividends. And when a company goes down, we've seen what happened in Steinhoff, we've seen what happens to Hewlett, we've seen what happened to a number of prestigious companies. What are we seeing? Obviously, there's been just a lull in terms of shareholder activism. You know, you're happy to grab and take fat bonuses and dividends, and you don't really question whether those kinds of dividends have compromised the culture, have compromised the sustainability of the company in the long term.
Yes. We in South Africa don't have a very strong tradition of shareholder activism. There are a number of people who have made it a practice and made it a mission to attend shareholders' meetings and to raise questions. And to a large extent, they've been treated as eccentrics or troublemakers, because I think what has also been a tendency in many companies, and I think Steinhoff is an example, is that you've actually got a very small number of shareholders, and sometimes even only one shareholder, who, despite the fact that it's a public company, effectively controls the whole of the company. So if the board enjoys the trust, or if that one shareholder is prepared to allow the board free rein, you're not going to get shareholder activism, because the activist shareholders constitute a very small minority. And so I think that has been the problem with a number of these, a number of the private sector companies that have gone wrong. In the public sector, of course, you've got the situation where most of our SOEs, or all of our SOEs, only have one shareholder. And that shareholder is the minister representing the government. And then that depends on the extent to which that person actually cares about proper private proper corporate governance, or is simply interested in pushing a political agenda through that particular entity.
Yeah, I mean, those are very useful observations that you made, which I completely agree with you. And again, going back to private sector, saying that we don't seem to have a robust shareholder activism, because if we had active shareholder activism, we would not be in a position where there's so many of prestigious companies, you know, going down the drain purely because the executives were being manipulating the shareholders. Because we've had instances where executives obviously are pushing their own agenda. That is why accountability lies not only with the executive, but also lies with the shareholder, because ultimately the shareholders are expected to know what has been the control environment in the short term and long term, not only just on an upside, but also on the downside. When you look at the SOEs, you're quite correct that the line minister is the representative of government. And again, there lies in issues of political interference. But let's look at the solution on the side of the private sector. What would you consider as some of the examples of how to navigate poor shareholder activism and a process where we are able to move away from the tick box and compliance, as we've seen in annual reports of most companies?
Yes, well, I think the answer to a large extent does lie in the legislation and in the King Codes, if they are properly adopted and properly lived, because those, certainly, as I've mentioned, the Companies Act has detailed provisions on the duties of directors. Once you get into the realm of public companies, there are board committees such as audit committees, social and ethics committees, and other governance committees that those companies are required to have, which should be advising the board. The question then is a culture where the board is actually listening to those people, and the board is not only taking on board the advice that they want to hear. It seems, if one looks at the Steinhoff example, that one of the biggest problems was that you did have one extremely dominant personality who cultivated a culture within the organization of idiots. So your board was your board committees didn't have the influence that they should have had. The non-executive directors didn't have the influence or didn't exert the governance functions that they should have had. Where there are non-executive directors, and in terms of the King Codes, companies at that level are required to have a panel of truly independent non-executive directors. Those non-executive directors are expected to actually be to acquaint themselves with the affairs of the company and make their views heard if they are unhappy with the affairs of the company. That, for example, in Steinhoff doesn't seem to have happened to the extent that it ought to have.
You know, you've raised a number of pertinent issues, which I want us to reflect on them deeply when we come back. Let's take a break. We'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, Making Sense of Doing Business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I'm joined by Ian Jacobsberg, who's a director at Flaxmans. We are talking about government lapses that we're seeing in both private and public sector organizations. Before we took that break, Ian was giving us a sense of some of the pertinent issues in both private and public sector organizations. For an example, in the part of the governance structures that is expected to advise the board is, you know, the subcommittees, and it raised
is the importance of dominant features or dominant figures, so to speak, dominant figures in some of those organizations. A case in point being Stanoff was one. We had one. And then not only Stanoff, pretty much across all entities, we do have that one or two dominant figure that would influence the board's thinking. But here's a question, Ian. If you, as a non-executive director, you have applied your mind, you know some of the risk which, if not attended to, would implicate you as an individual, as a non-executive director. I want to borrow from the Companies Act in relation to the business judgment rule. Surely, we ought to have seen or heard of massive exodus of directors purely because they so, despite the influence of one on dominant figures, they must have realized that their stay would put them in a precarious position for failing to adhered to a judgment, a business judgment rule in that here you are, you're likely to be personally held liable for some of the decisions that you have taken. Why are we not seeing exodus of directors saying, look, I can't have this name, I can't have this decision at my, and against my name. And if this decision goes ahead, I want it recorded that I was not in favor of this particular decision because these are the reasons. Are we putting our self-interest before, or are we putting the interest of the company first?
Yeah, well, I think you've answered the question in your last statement. I think that there are, unfortunately, vested interests, and that perhaps people are putting their own, which is exactly what the Companies Act and the fiduciary duty provisions of the Companies Act and the avoidance of conflicts of interest and all of those are trying to prevent. But I think possibly there isn't perhaps sufficient independent thought, or perhaps there isn't sufficient, can only use the word courage, in certain cases, to stand up and say those sort of things. One would expect that there would have been more of these cases, that if particularly independent non-executive directors had alert to what was going on in the company, that they would have taken further stance, or perhaps in certain cases they felt it was sufficient that they recorded their objections internally and it went on record that they were not in favor of particular decisions, and then they felt comfortable that if eventually the chickens did come home to roost, at least they would be able to point to the fact that they voted against a particular resolution.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the test is in the records, because when the chicken are coming home to roost, as you correctly pointed out, there would be something that exonerate some of those non-executive directors that would hang on. I was not in favor of that particular decision. But let's go back, because also I've seen entities such as UH where they got slapped and are on the wrist, and they obviously tried to resuscitate themselves purely because they were either misled or they were too comfortable in taking the benefit without asking deeper questions as they should. You know, but we've seen some of these punitive measures are not strong enough to send a message home that in an event that a company is found wanting by not applying diligence, serving the interests of the company, and all those things that the King Code as well as the Companies Act make reference to, what else needs to be done to create precedent? Because we've seen people that are resigning and there's no follow-up, whereas they have taken decisions that have put the company's public image in jeopardy.
Yes. Well, we certainly only know about the high-profile cases that make the media. But, I think there often is at that level that doesn't make the media or to the up to the point where it doesn't make the media, the bad publicity in itself is potentially bad for the company. So the companies often try to avoid it. We've seen it with various state-owned companies where pressure is just put on somebody to resign, and then on the basis that if they resign, they will not have to face the consequences of their actions. There will be no full disciplinary inquiry. There will be no criminal civil follow-up. And if they simply resign and go quietly, and sometimes we've even seen in the state-owned enterprises, they resign and go quietly with a very handsome payout. And that sometimes, to protect people who are still within the organization and to protect the reputation, as it were, of the organization itself, so that the real extent of the problem never sees the light of day.
Yeah, I mean, I personally can agree with you on the latter part of your statement, because if you let go or you put pressure on some of the executives to resign, and I suppose you're trying to do damage control purely because there's a whole lot of other horrifying lapses, issues that should not come to the light. Why I'm emphasizing this point: in May last year, the DPSA, reported that there were about 315 precautionary suspension of official. This is in the context of the public sector organizations. And further 219 precautionary suspensions. So if you have close to about 500 people, senior executives, that have been put on precautionary suspension, and some of these suspensions go over two, 3 year periods. What happens in instance where you put someone in a suspension, which means you have to get someone else to do that particular job, and while a person is on precautionary suspension, you still have to pay his or her salary. What sort of message are we sending to public when you have these kinds of issues?
Well, sure. I mean, it's not a good message, and that to a large extent is because sometimes there is a genuine intent to follow up properly. Sometimes there is just that the legal process and the investigative process does take a long time, and we have the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And so therefore, if a person is suspended, they do have to be suspended usually on full pay until they are found guilty of the offence concerned. We've seen, and it's just become the sort of paradigm example, as they call it, the Stalingrad tactics that our former president has employed to keep the litigation against him at bay for many years. And although I am one, I've got to say lawyers are good at doing that.
You're the first person to come across and meet the lawyers.
I beg your pardon?
I'm saying that's been an interesting observation, that lawyers are very good at it, but that's law. I mean, you have to argue on the basis of the law.
Yes, isn't it? Correct. And so that is why you hear and sometimes there are, from a legal point of view, valid reason, even if it is extremely frustrating as an outsider to watch this. What is concerning is the number of these cases that actually do never get finalized, because eventually the person resigns after having been on suspension with full pay for a few years.
But as a solution, I mean, I understand the legal route that needs to take place, because you presume innocent until proven guilty. And we have instances where, especially in the public sector, where the issues are never resolved. We've seen in so many of the state-owned entities, because of nefarious reasons behind the suspension, some of the cases never get resolved. But whose head should be hanged, so to speak? I would imagine as boards, board members or the chairperson of the board needs to account that this person has been on suspension, this matter has never been resolved. But I guess in some instances, some of those boards, the turnaround is not a turnaround, the turnover is very high, even the CEO. So you find people who are suspended going back because the CEO has been fired or he has left, the board has changed. So it's just a big mess, so to speak.
Yes, well, when you get into the realms of state-owned companies and SOEs, you've got, in any company that's incorporated under the Companies Act, which includes our SOEs, the shareholders appoint the board. In an SOE, as I said earlier, the shareholder is the minister who represents the government, and he has a political agenda. So what one often finds is that every time a minister is changed, the board of the SOE that reports to or that he controls will change, not for governance reasons, but or competence reasons, but for political reasons. I think that is why you always have, and then you get issues, because those people are employees, but now they are employees of an employer who doesn't want them, but they still have their rights in terms of the labor laws. And so then you get a protracted employment issue.
Those are quite interesting observations indeed. We're going to take a small break and we'll be back in a second to get our thinking a lot deeper on these very complex issues that Ian has shared with us.
Beyond Governance, Making Sense of Doing Business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I'm joined by Ian Jacobsbeck, who's a director at Flaxman. We are talking about governance lapses both in private and public sector organizations. And what has dawned based on our conversation with Ian is the complexities of governance in both entities. I suppose in private sector, they're less complex, but still very complex compared to the public sector, given the multi-layered and the political agenda that is very conspicuous when you looking at the line function minister, who is the shareholder, who's a proxy or representing the shareholder. Before we went to the break, we had a bit of insight on some of the protracted suspension cases at national and provincial level. And one, you have to contend with the labor law rights which every member is entitled to, but on the other level also have to take into account that you need to deliver services. If for you to deliver services, a person who has been suspended, they have to be replaced by someone else. In most instances, because these are senior people, you get inconsulted and who also don't add value in most of the instances. So we're seeing this siphoning of public purse, which led to the findings to the audit, by the Auditor General, and we still don't see much reprieve in terms of what happens, because the Auditor General will put effects on the table, but nothing really happens. Talking of that point, what should be done differently? Because the AG will come and pick up these issues that you have pointed out, and ultimately, we would have quantified the amount of loss based on some of the suspension. How should this issue be handled differently? Because in a private sector, somebody must, the shareholder will not be happy to see executives being put on a suspension for a duration of time without, of which in the process you are deriving, deriving value for that particular process. So what would your suggestion be to anybody who is listening to the show, who has been suspended and who's struggling to find a solution that would enable the entity not to find unsavory findings by the AG, because ultimately these issues do find expression in the AG's report?
Yes. Again, these audit processes do take a long time. And as you say, very often then someone's on suspension for a long time. Someone else comes in a temporary role, or consultants are employed to do the job that should be being done by employees of the organization. I think boils down to the fact that the King Code principles should be employed by SOEs, and for that matter, by other state bodies that run at the administrative level, where they're particularly in administration of finances. The principles of independence, the principles of the business judgment rule that you mentioned, and these organizations, because of the political agendas, I don't think those are always enforced. So you don't have a level of professional management which is truly independent of the political agendas. And I think the solution would be to have that level of professional management that is independent.
I suppose independent is a very, that's the gist of what we're trying to find at. And you and I would agree that independence, it's obviously very precarious, because if you have vested interest, it's very difficult, particularly in a public sector, because if you have been mandated from a political realm point of view, that level of independence, it goes out of the window. We have seen or heard in some of the boards, obviously in a public sector, the minister would appoint his proxies or his representatives, and those representatives find themselves in a very tough position because they are not able to exercise their independence as required by law, the duty to care, the duty to put the best interest of the company. So you have a situation where you have you obviously been put there by the minister, which suppose that you have the ear or interest of the minister, but the company that you are serving, the SOE that you're serving, is guided by laws around clean governance, about transparency, about accountability, not to the minister, but to the broader public. So I would imagine very difficult for those people who are confused to say, okay, who do I owe allegiance to? Do I owe allegiance to the minister appointed me, or do I owe allegiance to the company that is defined by the SOE founding mandate or founding act as well as King Code? It must be a very difficult conundrum for those executives to navigate that particular space. Your take on that?
Well, I think what you're touching on is more the human factor of an individual who obviously realizes that his fate is in the hands of the minister and therefore has to keep the minister happy. So now we're going into a different realm of problem, which is what is the agenda of the political oversight of these SOEs? We all know that we've been through a phase, and it's not over yet, where the SOEs are being manipulated for the benefit of specific people rather than for the general benefit of the public and the country. And so we've had executives who either willingly or under duress were forced to pursue a political agenda. We had the very publicized Dudumiani case at SAA, where she clearly just had a personal allegiance to the president, and she pursued that agenda at the expense of the company. And the only way of avoiding that is that the shareholder, being the government, does not treat the SOE as a political toy or that to be manipulated, but rather look at what its objective is in terms of the services that it's intending to that it is required to provide to the public, and the fact that it is ultimately intended to be a viable enterprise, and it must be run as a viable enterprise, and that requires the, if I can call it that, the goodwill and honesty of the political master.
Absolutely. Those are very complex issues that you've shared with us. And Pat, as we gravitate towards the end of the show, I want you, your thoughts, if you were to become a minister and advisor to the president, as an example, on these particular issues. I wonder what your advice would be. Let me put the context of this.
last year, the president, in his State of Nation address, indicated South Africans deserve a professional public service, a professional public service staffed by skilled and committed ethical people, and so on and so forth. So devoid of corruption, patronage, and wastage. So this is what the professionalization of the public sector guidelines, which have been debated and adopted by government. So as an advisor to the president, I would want to know what your approach would be in trying to guide the president away from these kind of issues. Let's take a break. We'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
When a nation comes together on buildrsa.co.za, it can only lead to a greater South Africa. All that's missing is you. Go to buildrsa.co.za to join the conversation, get involved in problem solving, and contribute to taking our nation to the next level. By South Africans, for South Africans. So, register for free now at buildrsa.co.za. The Great Africa. Together, we will build it.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Mbele. I am joined by Ian Jacobsberg, who is the director at Floodsmans. He's an attorney by profession. Before we took that break, I put to Ian that if he was to be an advisor to the president, given the challenge that we have alluded to in the public sector around corruption, maladministration, patronage, and wastage that we are seeing, there's a guidelines that has been put out there to try and professionalize the public service, which by virtue of conceding that you want to professionalize, you're saying the sector is not professional enough, I would imagine. So we need a professional public service staffed by skilled, committed, and ethical people, which is very critical. What would be your approach to try and, because I'm sure government, the president, is trying to get as many people as possible by his wayside to try and marshal the resources in a manner that will be used productively for the benefit of all, given the issue that you've raised. What will be your approach?
Well, I think you touched on it before the break, Nimrod. The solution is to have an independent and professional, and I emphasize the word professional, public service. We always used to, I haven't heard it said that much recently, but it was always was held up as an example, and that's the example of Britain, where you have people, the administrative heads of departments, the equivalent of what we call directors general, who were employed in those positions and remained in those positions for their entire careers and served under many, many different governments, but continued to do their job and were allowed to do their job on the basis that they were professionally skilled and competent to do the job because the objective of the department was clearly defined. And in the same way with an SOE, if the objective of that SOE is clearly defined and you have professional people who are running it to pursue that objective, what we've had in this country, and it doesn't only, it's not limited to the post-apartheid era. If one have, unfortunately, we have, if you have a look at the history of this country, we had one party in government for the entire second half of the 20th century. And then we've had another party, one party in government for the last 30 years. So we haven't had, so the party becomes identified with the state, and the agenda of that party then gets imposed on all of whatever enterprises and whatever business the state is engaged in, rather than a professional civil service and a professional management in the case of SOEs running those businesses on the basis of their own skills and professional skills.
What I'm picking up from you, Ian, is that the perhaps maybe the way out of this quagmire is insulating, you know, bureaucrats from the politicians, because that is the only way in which we could avoid manipulation of senior government officials, i.e. your DG and DDGs, because these are professional public servants and not politicians, and their objectives is to deliver what is required by law, not so much of the influence from the politicians. So personally, that could be one way out of this challenge, in that if you are able to insulate that one and giving the senior bureaucrat a specified tenure in the offices of which it's not linked necessarily to the tenure of the politicians. So irrespective of the minister, the DG should all remain, because in that case, the public service will likely to flourish. But that is not a solution that is practical in so many instances, because the minister has a political agenda and administrators are obviously more professional and need to push a particular idea. Are we at the level of sophistication enough for us to understand that that particular trajectory in your party, in short?
I think intellectually there is an understanding. Whether there is to use the term political will, and whether there and a real desire to achieve that, that is where we possibly are running into problems. There must be a genuine recognition that these departments, these SOEs, have a particular objective. They must be allowed to pursue that objective in the interests of their stakeholders.
Well, that's a very interesting observation indeed, Ian. And we unfortunately have run out of time. I wish we could have more and more of these insights, which are certainly illuminating some of the complexities that we are faced with, so that we, when we make a judgment, we also are able to contextualize the difficulties of some of the issues that public servants are experiencing. Ian, thank you very much for your time. We greatly appreciate your inputs, which I think has shed a huge benefit or light to the public, or someone has listened to the show and to enhance their understanding of some of the governance lapses that we have seen.
Thank you, Nimrod. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and I've found this discussion very stimulating myself.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Ian Jacobsbeck, who's the director at the Flexmans, giving us his observations around government lapses in both private and public sector organizations. And not only did we reflect on the challenges, but we also made a serious attempt to provide some of the solutions which could take this country forward, for it is in our best interest to do just that. Unfortunately, we have gone after leave a change. It's been an absolute pleasure. I certainly hope we've made a difference in your understanding of some of the complexities that we are faced with country. Like I said, it's always important to be kind, and for you don't lose anything, being kind to the next person. Shalom.